This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And if you're listening to us online at prairiepublic.org, we stream at the same time we broadcast. Thank you for joining us as well. And today we're going to start our show talking about a new industry with a couple of people who are in on the ground floor of this new industry. Veronica Michael is the CEO and Director of Sales and Marketing for Prairie Products Limited License Corporation. Thanks for being with us, Veronica.
Thank you for having us.
And with you is Tom Kading. He is the CFO and COO. He's got the Masters of Business Administration and the Juris Doctorate. Tom Kading, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you for having us.
In a nutshell, Veronica, what is Prairie Products?
So what we are is we are here to help farmers in our local region who are growing agricultural hemp bring that hemp to the marketplace. So what we do is we work with a strain of hemp that is grown for CBD. There are many different kinds of hemp that are grown, but our strain is grown for CBD. And we use cold ethanol extraction to extract the cannabinoids from the plant and to produce a crude form of the extract. You see that crude form out in the marketplace in a few different forms, actually, and what you probably have seen as CBD as one of the most popular cannabinoids.
Well, we see CBD everywhere now, pharmacies, in the newspaper, online. It's quite a product. It's taken off like crazy. Tom, how is this organization funded? How did you get started, and who else is involved with it besides you and Veronica?
So back in the fall of 2018 is kind of really when the hemp processing got kicked off. We looked at things and we said, you know, we had always had an interest in hemp. We'd been talking, Veronica and I and a couple others, since almost 2013. And we'd been talking about the hemp industry and what the opportunities were. And in the fall of 2018, there was a plan. Veronica kind of led the charge on that. We put the plan together. Structured a company and went out and raised some capital to start a hemp production facility. Lo and behold, the 2018 December Farm Bill passed, which opened up the CBD market. Initially, we said, you know, we're going to go after the hops market. We're going to begin in hops and move into CBD.
From beer to to cannabis.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's actually some – it's funny. There's some synergy because the plant is anti-inflammatory. People use hops in actually cosmetics a lot as an extract. We learned a lot about hops, Tom and I. And we knew that our equipment would be able to extract also that material. And that was something that helped us kind of jump in, not only to research what does extraction mean, what kind of equipment do you need, what are the processes in place, what's the best equipment, but to really make sure we better understood who is using these extracted products in the marketplace.
So how is it extracted? She mentioned this ethanol process.
So we use what's called a cold ethanol extraction method. There's a couple different methods out there, but we decided that cold ethanol is the best way to do it. And the other methods include using like things like propane or butane or high-pressure CO2. And we said, hey, propane, butane, they're explosive. CO2, 5,000 PSI, you're going to blow the roof of the building off if you do something wrong. Whereas ethanol works very well with the hemp plant and is very effective at taking the oil out of the plant and is a safe material to
work
with.
So you just soak it in ethanol? How do you do this? It's cold ethanol. Ethanol is explosive too if you get it hot enough.
Yeah, so we run our ethanol at a temperature negative 40 degrees Celsius. So
wow.
It's well below the
very
flash
cold.
Point. Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about CBD, Veronica. There are a lot of claims about it. What's it used for?
So the way that we first started hearing about CBD in the United States was actually back in the late 80s. And that was in early 90s when a family was trying to find ways to limit the amount of seizures their child was having. And they found that extracting CBD and dosing their child with that extract reduce her seizures. And that product became known as Charlotte's Web.
Wow.
Yeah. Charlotte's Web is an ethanol extracted product that was then used as medicine. Now, it wasn't just out of nowhere. This family wasn't, you know, trying to put their child in peril. They had read what many had read in the industry, which is some reports that had been done in Brazil, actually in South America in the 70s, that saw that there was benefit in the compounds, in the other compounds outside of THC, you know.
Which is the active ingredient in marijuana.
Correct. And it was just the psychotropic form of the compound. But the other things that are found in that plant are also super beneficial. They're beneficial to typically reduce inflammation. So that's why the application from hops or hemp on the skin can be really useful. Is it's an anti-inflammatory first. And some people find that it's really effective for pain. It can help to kind of soothe. Some people find their anxieties. Others say that it really helps them sleep. But I think ultimately what it's doing is it's calming us. It's calming the body in one way or the other that allows people to gain that wellness they're looking for.
Well, there's a ton of anecdotal evidence about that that goes back generations now. Tom, what part of the plant is used? All of it?
So we typically want to see really what's probably the top 12 inches of the plant. So we take what's called the buds, the flower, the dust or the keef. We take some of the small branches. We don't really want the big stem, kind of what is typically used for the fiber industry. We don't want that because there's not a lot of CBD in it.
Because a long time ago, back around the First World War, the hemp was grown for rope, sisal.
Exactly.
So you're using the top part of the plant. Where do you find the plants?
So North Dakota this year grew 3,900 or at least had 3,900 acres permitted in the state. Most of that was ended up being CBD. I don't have a firm number exactly the breakdown, but most of it was CBD hemp, and it was located really throughout the state, everywhere from the Valley to Bismarck and out west. Many other states are doing it as well, Minnesota, obviously, you know, Washington, Oregon, Colorado.
Well, you had a big article in the Farmers Forum last Friday where it was indicated that your first load came from Oregon, where, of course, marijuana cultivation has been legal for some time now. But now you can source locally?
Correct, correct. So we really like to think of our plant and differentiate ourselves from marijuana because, you know, the cannabis plant and the agricultural hemp that we're having farmers grow regionally really falls in to the farm bill that Tom had mentioned. Mm-hmm. So this plant really has a 0.3% THC, and that's something that by law the seeds are limited to having that kind of information in their species. How else would you want to say that, Tom?
Absolutely. We are not in the THC industry at the end of the day.
I'm clear. And that's clear. But the problem is that the plants might have more than 0.3%.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So one of the things we do to combat that and try to be effective at that is making sure we have good genetics. So the number one driver in terms of what the biomass is at the end of the day is the genetics. And if we have good genetics on the front side, we can get a good crop. And farmers test it in the field multiple times. They test it 15 days before harvest. When it gets to our plant, we test it. And again, when it leaves our plant, we test it again. So it's very highly tested. And if those genetics are wrong, you know, it's not going to get to our plant.
So that sounds like a regulatory headache in a way, though. I mean, there's several levels where it has to be tested to meet this THC boundary, if you will. Are there enough people doing that?
It's certainly a challenge, and there's certainly some regulatory challenges we're dealing with. Fortunately, you know, that's what we want to do too. So one of the things we do is we're working to be a GMP compliant facility. And what that means is we want to have a very consistent product on the front side. So whether we're manufacturing a hemp oil or, you know, working with potatoes, we want to test our incoming product and we want to test our outgoing product. So we would do it irregardless of the industry.
Tom Kading is the Chief Financial Officer and the Chief Operating Officer for Prairie Products. Veronica Michael is the CEO and Director of Sales and Marketing. Veronica, who are you selling it to?
So our original plan was to sell on the wholesale market to those who wanted to put this ingredient into their product, or maybe into a lotion, into a tincture, into a pet product. So one thing that we found as a challenge as we moved into the industry is because we are at this kind of in-between spot with USDA regulation and FDA, many product manufacturers have slowed their buying down to really wait for a few months to figure out what that regulation will look like. For us, that's why Tom mentioned gaining our GMP certification, getting registered with the FDA is so important for us, as we know more and more product makers want to put this ingredient in their products, but we need to make sure that we're standing out ahead of the crowd and that we comply to the regulatory needs they have as industry. So that makes our selling complicated.
So are you kind of treading water now, just waiting for the market to stabilize?
Exactly. I think that that is a place that we are at. I mean, we are definitely working with farmers locally to bring in a product. We've made some sales and connected with some manufacturers, but not at the pace that we'd like. We hope that as the regulation becomes more clear in the next few months, sales in general will increase because more product manufacturers will know what they need to do to stay in that regulatory space.
Tom is the guy who's watching the in and out in terms of where the capital's going and how much it's costing to operate this. How many months do you have?
Well, one exciting thing we've done is we rolled out a retail product. And that's really our plan for this year is we have this retail product. That's what's moving right now. And we're really looking to push the retail side. We have it. We launched that last week. We're going to have a launch party here in 2 weeks. And we're really hoping to get that into the Fargo market.
Well, let's talk to the sales director here. What is the product?
So the products we have a few different products, actually. But I want to say first, we recognize that not everyone feels confident trying CBD or trying the product. And we know that we're working with great farmers in North Dakota to grow a really high quality product. We're working at our lab here in Fargo to produce a really high quality crude. So what we really understand is we wanted people in North Dakota to be able to experience our product, but to do that, we remediated the THC. So we have four products. Three of our products are THC free. And the reason is we see that there's such a benefit in trying the cannabinoid of CBD, and we'd like to reduce any worry that people might have in having any trace of THC in it. So the first product we have is a lotion. It is kind of to soothe sore muscles. We call it a recovery lotion. Nerve pain, all of us, sore knees and hips, things like that. The next product we have is a tincture for sleep. I think sleep eludes many of us. So instead of just being formulated with CBD, we decided to also formulate with a bit of valerian root and melatonin because we recognize a lot of people struggle with sleep. The next product that we have is a chewable tablet. And all of those three are THC-free products that you can check out at www.prairieproductsnd.com. But then our last product is one that is formulated for pain and inflammation. And in that formulation, we decided to make that product follow the Farm Bill. So that does contain 0.3% THC. But those are the products we're starting with. We've had a really warm reception in our community with people who are looking to try something and would like to try something local.
You know, there are vitamins and supplements that have been sold for a long, long time that people believe in but don't necessarily have the scientific affirmation behind them. What can you tell us about these products?
Well, we really looked hard to find formulators that we thought were doing something intriguing in the industry, and we were really fortunate to be able to get to work with these products, especially with a compounding pharmacist and a bioscientist that really knew their stuff and understood what they were doing with formulating the product. To make something with a THC-free distillate, we call it, it's important then you bring in other terpenes, other cannabinoids to really make it more effective. What you're asking, though, is how do we know our products are effective? And I think that's the struggle our old industry is having currently is you need research to make claims, correct? But you also need your product to be a legal ingredient to be researched.
Yes, and that's been a stumbling block for cannabis since it was outlawed in the 30s.
Exactly.
Made a Schedule I drug by the federal government. Tom, when you get into the production of the crude oil, this is the CBD oil itself, what kind of units are we talking about? What is a sales unit here? Is it a quart? Is it a gallon? Is it a barrel? How do you sell it?
So we typically sell crude oil in kilograms. So kilograms at a certain percentage of potency. So for example, you know, we might sell a 25-kilogram batch, and typically buyers are buying it by the source material.
Okay. So who's buying it?
So our product would end up – we've been really working to get our product in our retail product, so that's where mm-hmm. we want it to end up. But other buyers outside ourselves include capsule makers, tincture makers, and topicals. Those are kind of the three main things. Approximately 35% of the market is tinctures currently.
Okay. So what's the arrangement with the grower here? How does the grower benefit from working with Prairie Products?
So a grower in North Dakota might come in and say, hey, I have an acre of hemp and I'd like it to be processed. Grower comes in and gets theirs tested, verifies, you know, we have 9% CBD in the crop. And we contract with them. And the contract arrangement we do is what's called a split contract. And what that means is they bring in their product, we process it, and they get back 50% of the oil, we get back 50% of the oil. It's not always a 50-50. Depends on a number of factors, but that's just an example. This is very typical in the industry all over the country. Split processing is what most processors are awarding right now. And one of the reasons it benefits the farmer to do a split process, so over the last 12 months, the market for biomass to the farmers has fallen significantly. And if a farmer does a split contract, they get the possibility that the market goes back up. So they get the upside of the market.
Well, is there a way to characterize what an acre of hemp at 9% would be worth?
So today's prices, let's say your acre produces 1,000 pounds of biomass that comes to us at 9%, they're going to get approximately, if they were to sell it on the open market, not in a split agreement, they might get about 7,000.
Wow. So that there are commodity exchanges, obviously, for wheat and soybeans and corn and all that. Is there eventually going to be a commodity exchange for CBD?
We hope so.
We hope so. We hope so.
Well, getting back to the product itself, Veronica, do you guys use it?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I thank you for asking that. I actually started using CBD myself. And that's why I really came to this understanding that I know it can work for the human body. And really believe that it's something worth trying. And I think a lot of people are looking for – I think a lot of us have lots of jars of bottles and jars in our cupboards that have been purchased and not worked for us. Everyone's efficacy is a little bit different. You know, everyone's trying to figure out how can I feel a little bit better but still be really alert and work hard. So, yes, I do use it.
Veronica Michael is the CEO, Director of Sales and Marketing for Prairie Products, and Tom Kading is the CFO, COO, and an investor of sorts at Prairie Products. You can find out more at prairieproductsnd.com. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Barb Gravel, host of the television show Prairie Musicians on Prairie Public, Oakland.
Break out these chains, let's burn it down.
Anchorage. New Orleans.
Crispy treats and noodles. Home alone, Macaulay Culkin. Cause sometimes, I need more space than sauce can give me. More sky than God provides me.
Columbus, Georgia. What do these places have in common? They're some of the hometowns of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest winners. The 2020 edition is on, and we'd love to see someone from North Dakota, Eastern Montana, or Northwest Minnesota win it all this year. So Prairie musicians over 18, soundcheck, and then film yourself performing an original song in front of the Tiny Desk of your choice. Then upload it onto YouTube and do a little dance for luck, because it'll be judged by a distinguished panel that includes multiple Grammy winner Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. The winner will perform at the iconic Tiny Desk in D.C. and embark on a 10-city U.S. concert tour with NPR Music. Entries must be in by March 30th. Just go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest for complete rules and to upload your clip.
Are you ready?
We're so thrilled to welcome the winner of the Tiny Desk Contest!
The 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Go for it, Prairie musicians!
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Dr. Christopher P. Lehman. He is a professor of African American Studies at St. Cloud State University. He joins us by phone to discuss his new book. Thanks for joining us, Christopher.
Thanks for inviting me.
The book is Slavery's Reach. It's published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. It's a finalist for a Minnesota Book Award, and it tells some intriguing stories about the connection of the state of Minnesota with the slave trade. Christopher, how did this book come to be?
Well, it came about, I'd say, about 4 years ago when I started trying to find ways that were documented in which Minnesota was connected to the country's slavery economy. And the documents that were most accessible to me were real estate deeds, because I could go to any county recorder office and look up the deeds. So what I did for the next 4 years was to go to counties that were primarily along the Mississippi River, since that would have been a direct geographical connection to the South. And of those Minnesota counties, I wanted to make sure that they were organized before 1865, since slavery would have been legal before 1865. And I went through all the deeds, and I wrote down the name of every Southerner that was listed on a deed, and I wrote down the name of where in the South that person lived. And then at the end of each day at one of these recorder offices, I would go home, and I would look up lists of slaveholders from those particular counties. And if the name on the deed was in the list of the names of slaveholders, then I knew that the deed was the paper trail, in which there was a recording of a monetary transaction from a plantation in the South to the hands of a Minnesotan. And what I wanted to do with my book was to show that even though slaves were not physically present in Minnesota in great number, they didn't have to be in order for Minnesota to benefit financially from slavery.
So when Minnesota was a territory, it became a state in 1858, and then not long after that, there's the Civil War, largely over the issue of slavery, among other things. But the state was, or the territory, was a destination for investors, I take it.
That's right. Southerners would come to Minnesota to invest in real estate. Some of them were slaveholders who wanted to diversify their investment portfolios and not be totally reliant on the plantation economy. But there were other Southerners who were the sons of slaveholders who were definitely wealthy because of the slaves that their parents held. But they themselves weren't interested in becoming slaveholders, but they used that money that they received from their parents to invest in real estate in Minnesota. And they would invite Southerners who were slaveholders to buy land from them in Minnesota. So they were able to benefit from other people's generation of money through slavery without having to own slaves themselves.
Well, some of those landowners or Minnesotans by tradition are prominent in our history. There are counties named after them. There are all kinds of places mm-hmm. named after them. Give us a sense of who these people are.
Yes. Well, the people who we would consider to be Minnesota's founding fathers, like Henry Rice and Henry Sibley and John Prince, all of them were fur traders, and the Minnesota fur trade at one point was run by the American Fur Company. And the American Fur Company was a company that was co-owned by three slaveholders down in St. Louis, Missouri. So whenever Rice and Sibley and Prince were working for the fur trade, they were getting paid by these Missouri slaveholders. So whatever money that Rice and Sibley and Prince used to develop Minnesota was tainted by slavery.
Christopher Lehman is a professor of African-American studies at St. Cloud State University. We're talking about his new book, Slavery's Reach, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press, talking about the influence of slaveholders in the founding of our state and the development of it. Christopher, was there a consensus opinion among settlers of the Minnesota Territory before statehood in 1858 about the legitimacy of slavery?
Well, they were convinced that a slavery economy just would not work in Minnesota, meaning that it would not be conducive to try to have large plantations in Minnesota. The soil won't cooperate and neither would the weather. However, it certainly was just fine and it was perfectly legal for slaveholders and Minnesotans to do business with each other as long as they weren't selling people. So Minnesotans were perfectly fine with being almost totally dependent in some communities on this money from Southern slaveholders. Now, there were a few people who might have been worried about just how influential the South would be through their money in Minnesota. But primarily, Minnesota's communities, especially along the Mississippi River, welcomed the money that came with Southern visitors, especially Southern tourists, during the summer months. And they would just look the other way, or they would rationalize that since they weren't the ones doing the enslaving, it was perfectly fine to take money from the people who were.
So a steamboat comes up the Mississippi and lands at maybe Stillwater eventually. They're investors or tourists, and would they not occasionally bring a slave along with them? And if they did, what was the status of that person in the territory of Minnesota?
Well, when Minnesota was a free territory and a free state, then legally speaking, that slave would become free upon arriving in Minnesota. However, in 1857, the Supreme Court had the Dred Scott decision, which said that every territory can legally have slavery. And Minnesota was still a territory back then. It would not be a state for another 14 months.
And Minnesota had a role in that Dred Scott decision, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, because Dred Scott was kept in Minnesota at Fort Snelling. And so it was based on him being in a free area that when he was taken back to Missouri, he sued, saying that he should be free since he was in a free area. But the Supreme Court ultimately said no. Oh, and the person that Dred Scott sued was John Sanford, who was one of the three partners of Choteau and Company. This is connected in all sorts of ways.
Well, this Supreme Court decision, the Dred Scott decision, in effect, according to your work, legalized slavery in all territories, including Minnesota, until statehood 14 months later.
That's right. So during that spring and summer of 1857, when Southerners brought slaves to Minnesota, they were still slaves legally. They did not become free during that 14-month period.
Now, you mentioned that Dred Scott had been at Fort Snelling. Was there a unique status of officers who would bring slaves to a fort and where they were serving in Minnesota Territory?
Well, what happened with Fort Snelling was that after it was built, there was a contingent of military officers from Missouri who were sent to Fort Snelling, but as an incentive for the officers to come here, the federal government said that if they wanted to bring one or two slaves with them, they could, and that the government would give them a stipend to take care of them. But this was already after there had been two federal laws passed to say that slavery could not be in Minnesota. So the federal government was disobeying its own law for the sake of having a strong military presence at Fort Snelling.
Well, when these people from the South would stop at St. Peter or St. Paul or Stillwater, and they would come into a hotel, they might have a slave with them. What happened to the slave?
Well, in the registers that I've looked at, the people would always be signed as a group. So if an entire family came, the head of the family, typically a man, would sign his name and then and wife or and family plus servant or plus nurse. would never use the word slave. They would always use some other kind of term. Mm-hmm. But they would all be signed in together. So if they all stayed in the same room, then I would assume that the nurse or the servant would have just had to sleep on the floor.
So for the most part, people would see someone of color in a town like that, and they would have to most likely assume that that was a slave, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And Minnesotans were aware that Southerners who were coming to Minnesota for weeks and months at a time were wealthy, and that they were wealthy because they were slaveholders. So there was certainly awareness of that happening in Minnesota. And there were some people who lived in those tourist towns who did not like that. And at least in the Minneapolis area, whenever there would be a steamboat that would disembark, there would be a crowd of people who were anti-slavery who would boo whenever the Southerners would get off the boat.
Was there anything like an underground railroad for slaves in Minnesota river towns like the Twin Cities?
No, not that far up north. There definitely was a point in Stillwater that was part of an underground railroad that would help slaves get into Canada. But in the rest of the state, I don't think so.
Let's talk a bit about the economics of slavery here for a moment. What was the relative value of a slave during this time that we're talking about?
Well, it depended on age and it depended on gender. So typically a male slave who was between the age of 20 and the age of 35 would be the most valuable, and probably $800 to $1,000 each. A woman of the same age might be $100 less, but could also be the same value, especially if that woman could produce children, because by giving birth to slaves, that saves the master from having to buy a slave.
Hmm. So they're symbols of wealth.
A young adult,
yeah.
Right. So a young adult would be $800 to $1,000. A teenager or a slave in their 30s and 40s would be $600 to $800 each. And then someone who's grade school age, and then someone who is in their 50s and 60s would be worth $400 to $600. And then the elderly in their 60s and early 70s would be worth $200, and so would babies and toddlers. And once you get elderly to the point of not being able to walk or see well, then you wouldn't be worth more than $50, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a prevalent attitude about service in general at that time. I mean, the people of means would have servants. In the North, maybe they wouldn't be people of color, but they would be family servants. And for that matter, Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, their family had a servant, a black boy, I think, at that time, a young man, very young man, about, Samuel's age. So did it cost less to have a slave than a servant who was of your own race?
Well, certainly if you had a slave, then you wouldn't have to pay that person a salary or a wage, but you would be responsible for the clothing and the feeding and the sheltering of that slave, but you could use the bare minimum of that to save whatever money you wanted to save. But when you're employing a civilian or a free person, then you do have to negotiate with them, and you have to give them a payment that they're going to want to receive in order for them to do the work that you want them to do.
Yeah, and there might be some work no one would want to do, and of course they would have the right to just walk away if they didn't want to. So,
right.
Is it likely that other states with similar connections to Southern slaveholders have similar problematic histories, particularly along rivers?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. Whenever I would find names of slaveholders, I would also look at newspaper accounts to see if there were reports about them. And I would very often come across newspaper accounts of Southerners traveling to Minnesota, but because they're on their way to Iowa, too. And those reports talk about Southerners investing both in Minnesota and in Iowa on the same trip. So certainly Iowa has that history, and I wouldn't be surprised if Wisconsin did too.
You've written several pieces for Minnesota History Magazine. One was Black Cloud, The Struggle of St. Cloud's African-American Community, back around the turn of the 20th century and before. And The Contemplation of Our Righteousness was another one, Vigilante Acts Against African-Americans in Southwest Minnesota. Now, Minnesota has had and has a reputation as a relatively progressive state. Was it less receptive than other places in the North to African-American resettlement after the Civil War?
Well, I think it depended on the area, especially the politics of the area. For example, in St. Cloud, there had historically been dominance of the Democrat Party. And back then, in the 1850s at least, and earlier, the Democratic Party was very pro-slavery, and then afterward, very much pro-segregation. And if that's the politics of the community, then that's not going to attract African Americans there, because at the time, African Americans tended to vote Republican, since the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and the party of Emancipation Proclamation and so forth. So if the politics were more Republican, then that's where African Americans would go. So that alone would account for why there would be a greater presence in the Twin Cities versus in St. Cloud.
And yet there aren't significant pockets of African Americans outside of the Twin Cities, are there, during that time?
No. No, there aren't. And the thing about St. Cloud, especially, is that the African-American population was those few slaves who came with slaveholders who decided to stay in Minnesota permanently. They were very few in number. Most of them were just here temporarily on a vacation. But there were some who were here full time. But when the Civil War broke out, Southerners returned to the South with their slaves, and that would cause a drain of African-American populations in Minnesota. So the population of St. Cloud ultimately went down to zero during the Civil War. And there would be pockets of time when they would return, but then they would leave again. But it's only been since 1883 that there has been at least one African-American living in St. Cloud.
That said, northern states, and we're talking about Minnesota in particular here, have histories of virulent racism, regardless of the fact whether they were ever slaveholder states or ever had a significant population of African Americans. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because you had to have communities with resources to help people who were coming out of slavery. And Minnesota just did not have those resources very much outside of the Twin Cities. And then you had states that were in the West and the Northwest that were extremely hostile to the presence of African Americans, whether they were free or slave. In Iowa, in Utah, and other places, there were laws that said that there was not supposed to be any slavery, but we don't want any free African-Americans living here either. Fortunately, Minnesota was never such a state. There was never any state law that said that no free African-American could live in Minnesota. But it would be extremely difficult for African-Americans to come to Minnesota and then settle in the communities, again, especially if some of them had Democratic leanings.
And we're reminded in 2020 that in 1920, there was a savage lynching in Duluth. Three African-American men were murdered by a mob.
Right. That'll be 100 years ago this June when that happened. And when I wrote the other articles about St. Cloud and about Montevideo, I wanted to point out through those articles that Duluth was not an isolated incident. It wasn't an anomaly. Whatever happened in Duluth could have happened anywhere because there was anti-African-American sentiment all over the state. It was just in Duluth where it reached its most violent point.
Well, you mentioned in your Minnesota Magazine history piece, The Contemplation of Our Righteousness, Vigilante Acts Against African-Americans in Southwest Minnesota, the year 1903 implicated these kinds of issues in Montevideo and Olivia. So there's plenty of history to comb through, I guess.
Absolutely. There are quite a few stories that are untold, and I think that's what makes Minnesota such an interesting place for me to do research, because the things that I've been able to find in my 18 years of being here have been just very eye-opening, because I had my own ideas about Minnesota before I got here, that it was a free place and that slavery didn't have that much of an influence because there just weren't that many African Americans. That was my mindset coming into the state. But the more that I read and the more that I found on my own, the more that I learned that I was just plain wrong.
Dr. Christopher Lehman is a professor of African American Studies at St. Cloud State University and the author of the new book, Slavery's Reach, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Last Monday, the annual North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition took place at the State Heritage Center and Museum in Bismarck. Our Bill Thomas attends each year and brings back samples of the students reciting poems, and he hears them all because he's one of the judges.
I am a judge. It's so interesting to really concentrate on the readings of these students. As I say readings, they're reciting from memory, actually, poems, not their own poems. It's not a poetry slam. They have poems by, you know, respected published poets that are selected from a group, a catalog that's put together by the Poetry Foundation that's one of the sponsors of the event.
Well, tell us about this year's event. What made it special?
Yeah. Well, it almost felt like Class B basketball because they were predicting bad weather. It was like, oh, different schools might pull out. And a couple of schools actually did pull out because they were worried about being able to get back home. And Solon High School from down on Standing Rock that was there, they had to leave early because of the weather. But actually, mostly the weather for most of the state turned out to not be so bad. And I thought the average quality of the reading was really good. Some great poems. The kids picked the poems in cooperation with their teachers and coaches that work with them, and some great poems picked this year.
Well, should I just say, let's listen to what you brought back.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, the first one is the third place winner, Katie Meester from Valley City High School.
To Solitude by Alice Carey. I am weary of the working, weary of the long day's heat. To thy comfortable bosom wilt thou take me, spirit sweet? Weary of the long blind struggle for a pathway bright and high. Weary of the dimly dying hopes that never quite all die. Weary, searching a bad cipher for a good that must be meant. Discontent with being weary, weary with my discontent. I am weary of the trusting, where my trusts but torments prove. Wilt thou keep faith with me? Wilt thou be my true and tender love? I am weary, drifting, driving like a helmless bark at sea. Kindly, comfortable spirit, wilt thou give thyself to me? Give thy birds to sing me sonnets, give thy winds my cheeks to kiss, and thy mossy rocks to stand for the memorials of our bliss. I in reverence will hold thee, never vexed with jealous ills, though thy wild and wimpling waters wind about a thousand hills.
Katie Meester from Valley City High School, and that was a poem from the 19th century.
One of the interesting things about Poetry Out Loud is the students are required to pick a poem from before 1900. That obviously was one of them. Now, interestingly, this next one by the second place winner, Kylie Howitt, is a very contemporary poem. It is written by a living poet who actually happens to be the current poet laureate of the United States, Joy Harjo. So here is Poetry Out Loud second place winner, Kylie Howitt from Northern Cass High School.
Don't Bother the Earth Spirit by Joy Harjo. Don't bother the earth spirit who lives here. She is working on a story. It is the oldest story in the world, and it is delicate, changing. If she sees you watching, she will invite you in for coffee, give you warm bread, and you will be obligated to stay and listen. But this is no ordinary story. You will have to endure earthquakes, lightning, the deaths of all those you love, the most blinding beauty. It's a story so compelling you may never want to leave. This is how she traps you. See that stone finger over there? That is the only one who ever escaped.
Kylie Howitt of Northern Cass High School reading Don't Bother the Earth Spirit by Joy Harjo. Now, next we're going to hear from Maria Kalb, and she won top honors at the Poetry Out Loud contest. And before we hear her reading her poem, I thought it'd be interesting. I interviewed her a little bit, and she talks about the process and how it works. And for her, it was especially interesting because she's been in this contest more than 1 year. She's a senior this year, and that gave her some special privileges.
Totally up to me of picking poems and finding poems. And so in January, students who are interested at St. Mary's sign up, and they memorize two poems, and then they compete. And based on who wins the school competition, they are chosen to represent their school and go on to the state competition.
So does the school competition take place like in classrooms or at an assembly, or like how do you do it in front of the whole school? Or
for St. Mary's, we did it before school one day. Everyone who was interested in competing went into a classroom, and we all competed there. We had our English department judge, and one of our English teachers were a prompter. And then we also had a guest judge come in who is a poet himself, which was really cool.
So you've done this in previous years. So you've been through the whole process before, and you understood about picking a poem, and you had to do it yourself this time. So what was that like?
Well, of course, I could always reach out to my English teachers and ask them if they had any recommendations and stuff. But also just poems that I was interested last year with, I also looked at again, and I ended up choosing one of them.
How many did you go through?
Oh, I went through tons. I almost went through the entire list of just like looking at the beginning and endings of the poems, and which like struck out at me. And yeah, it was a long process, but.
So do you look at it and go like, wow, this one would be really great to read, but ooh, it might be hard. Or,
Right. But it all changes. Like even though it looks great on paper, like even when you just say it out loud, it changes it completely. So just like having to like try to incorporate it with your own voice makes it even more interesting of selecting a poem.
You went through all those and you picked them, and then how'd you work on them to work them up for the performance?
I basically analyzed the poem, like, is there a rhyme scheme? Is there a story being told? Like, is there something being symbolized? And then I just say it over and over and over again until I finally got it nailed down.
Well, and that sounds like pretty good technique. It worked well for Maria Kalb. She is the top place winner in the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud statewide contest. And next, we're going to hear the first poem that she read. She ended up reading three during the course of the contest. And afterwards, she'll explain a little bit about her interpretation of it.
Snowflake by William Baer. Timing's everything. The vapor rises high in the sky, tossing to and fro, then freezes suddenly and crystallizes into a perfect flake of miraculous snow. For countless miles, drifting east above the world, whirling about in a swirling free-for-all, appearing aimless, just like love, but sensing, seeking out its destiny. Falling to where the two young skaters stand, hand in hand, then flips and dips and whips itself about to ever so gently land. A miracle across her unkissed lips. As he blocks the wind raging from the south, leaning forward to kiss her lovely mouth.
Maria Kalb of St. Mary's Central High School in Bismarck, she explains her understanding of the poem.
It explains the fate of one single snowflake and how, like, every little tiny thing, such as a tiny snowflake, can make such a big difference to a story. So, yeah, it talks about the snowflake, and it's whirling about in a little storm, and it meets two skaters. And, yeah, it was just a really cute, fun, whimsical story of a little snowflake.
Sounds like you had a good day on Monday.
Oh, yeah, it was really nice hearing these students just do outstanding job, so many of them. I thought the average quality of the performances was quite high this year.
And, of course, there are judges that are looking at various criteria for
making
the choice.
Evidence of understanding, the dramatic appropriateness, the physical presence, articulation, all of those kind of things are specifically scored.
And accuracy.
Accuracy, yes.
So this winner goes on to the national competition.
Yeah, that's around the end of April. She'll go to D.C. and compete in the nationals, and the national winner gets $20,000.
Wow. And more than three dozen schools and Poetry Out Loud competitors that were involved on Monday.
I think this is one of the higher years in terms of participation. It's work for the schools. It's work for the teachers to fit it into curriculum. So everybody doesn't do it. You know, you've got to have somebody who's got an interest in it and will kind of champion it at the high school to make sure it happens. It's not like football or basketball where everybody just does it. It takes some work to get it in there.
And the State Council on the Arts helps make it possible.
Yeah, the State Council on the Arts, the Humanities North Dakota Group helps fund it, the Poetry Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts all sponsor it.
All right. Well, Bill Thomas, thanks again for bringing us up to date on this year's contest.
Well, we'll be back with some more poems as we go along through the month.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it to you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco. Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning wherever you are when you tune in tomorrow for Morning Edition from NPR News.
Beginning at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.